and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It is me, Chris Denson, your gracious host. If you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, shame on you. But if you are, this show covers all things ideas, creativity, success, smart people doing smart things. And today, the buck does not stop. I'm here at Studio 71, right? We got the numbers.
The numbers are correct.
Okay, cool. why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves? Because I don't want to botch this. This is I love this dynamic duo.
Dynamic duo. I'll go first. Is that okay?
Please.
Okay. Please. I'm Reza Izzat. I'm one of the authors of Create Great Videos.
I'm Jake Green, and I'm the other author of Create Great Videos.
All right. So how do you guys share? How did you battle over the authoring title? Who gets second billing?
I don't think it was a question of first or second billing. That's not how it really went.
I went second billing because I think, was it Shaquille O'Neal who said you got to let the big dog eat?
I guess you can say it that way.
Yeah. I'm definitely Robin in the relationship, and I'm proud to be so.
That's super nice.
Well, let's in case some people have been living under a rock, let's do a little bit of what is Studio 71, Reza, and how did you come to be at the helm of it?
Sure. I'll just give you a little professional background because I think it contextualized what we do at Studio 71. I've spent most of my career in sort of the talent representation business in the traditional sense. I started as an agent at a company called United Talent Agency, where I was the agent for Eminem and Justin Timberlake, and I was involved in putting together the music piece from that movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was really fun and exciting.
And Trouble.
Exactly. Man of Constant
Sorrow. One of my favorite soundtracks.
And many. Yeah.
Good job.
Great story around all that.
Interview over.
I'm over.
We can thoroughly be done impressed.
And I got recruited to join a management company that was run by a guy named Michael Green, and he was running the company. And he'd started the company in the mid-2000s, and he had a big thesis that what was happening with sort of digital would allow creative people to go direct to consumer. And hopefully, if you built the right sort of infrastructure, you could capture a lot of rights, incremental rights, that were traditionally going to record labels and other third parties. And so, for the most part, that thesis didn't play out in music. Like, where that thesis played out in music was, you know, it was a lot more efficient to sell concert tickets, leveraging things like Facebook and things like that. But only today are we seeing artists that are truly building themselves on platforms and building huge careers off of it. You know, the SoundCloud artists that everyone sort of speaks in a derogatory way about these days. The reality is those guys have built massive consumer followings and are able to now monetize. 10 years ago, that wasn't really the case.
And what was it 10 years ago, whenever you got started?
10 years ago, there was no streaming music business.
True. But as far as like talent, right?
You know, talent was always the cornerstone. And talent's still the cornerstone of our business.
And of course, but to like venture into this sort of newfangled medium, and even today, where people don't necessarily take those artists seriously as they would traditional artists, and that's not to say that's universal. Some people are like, I don't get it. Why I would take that leap of faith at that point in time?
I'll tell you. That was what we were thinking. So we were very oriented and believed that this was coming. We'd signed an artist, a kid named Lucas Cruikshank, who created the character Fred on YouTube. And in 2009, that was the biggest, you know, thing on the platform. There was a manager here who had signed him. And when I remember when we were talking, I said, why would you sign this? I don't quite understand.
What have you done?
This is. Yeah, what is this? And, you know, if you look at the numbers, and these were very unsophisticated sort of looking at the numbers, I remember looking at, there's Universal Music Group. He's bigger than all of Universal Music Group. In fact, he's bigger than almost every artist on this platform. There must be something there. So let's see what there is there. So somebody also in the office said he spoke, you know, if you know the character Fred, it speaks in a very high-pitched voice. And somebody sort of said some version of, well, you know, the Chipmunks sold a lot of novelty records. Let's make a record. So we put them in studio with some really, you know, competent producers, and we made a novelty Christmas record. And we connected YouTube and iTunes, and we sold 100,000 copies very quickly. No other marketing, not a lot of fanfare, no radio, nothing else. And that was like, wow, we should look at what is this world this kid has actually created. And when you get into Fred and you can get past the voice for a second, it's a very in-depth world. And so we brought in some partners because we didn't have all the creative firepower to sort of enhance that world. And we financed a low budget movie, and we thought it was going to go theatrical, and we had all these grand dreams, but it ended up being very, very successful. We licensed that movie to Nickelodeon in 2010. The Fred movie was the highest rated movie in all of cable television. And we did three of them, and we did 25 half hours of TV. And Lucas had like the real ownership position in it. Like if you think about like ownership, he had a real strong position in it because he created this character in this universe. We as managers had a position in it because we put up capital and helped the marketing and all these things. And our creative partner had a big position in. So everybody did very well on it. And that sort of set off a whole bunch of light bulbs in our head that maybe this space, that there's a lot more creativity and a lot more opportunity in this space than maybe we had imagined. That if we look past what was at the time the skateboard video and the cute cat video, that there's a lot of value in this space. And when you fast forward today, I mean, there's a lot of people who've built or told a version of this story 100 times over. And I think that's one of the things that we wanted to showcase in the book, and one of the things that we want to highlight, that this is, you know, if you're not taking, you know, this creator class seriously, and you may misinterpret some of the behaviors, right? Because it's very youthful.
Yep.
You're completely missing the mark.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Jake, you come in from the other side of the bookend, if you will, going from talent to, you know, sort of writer, creator. Mm-hmm. Kind of explain your journey and how you guys ended up coming together.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was 10 years ago, I had a book that came out that was a sort of Ferris Bueller-esque career guide, and that it came on the back of me working for a lot of weird startups and having some just horrible career development stories that I wanted other people to be able to learn from, and it was cathartic to write it all down. But that sort of got me into the space where I started working with a lot of organizations on intergenerational differences and sort of the culture clash as social media was becoming a bigger and bigger thing. And so I was living in Tennessee at the time, and so I would sort of a bank would bring me in, and they'd sit me down and they'd say, "Now, why are we going to have to pay attention to this Twitter thing?" And then, you know, I'd spend 45 minutes telling them why they had to.
I could see that guy when you did it. That was pretty good.
Dude, it was. I
know that person.
What kind of stain did he have?
Quick, so.
Yeah, what stain was that?
Quick,
yeah,
quick sidebar, because I know we've got a little bit more space to breathe in this podcast than some others. At one point, it was me and a couple other guys, and we were touring all over the South teaching people about like social media. And so you could show up at one of our events, and for $30, you'd learn all about Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn, and you get some Southwestern egg rolls. And we always used to try to overbook these events, because, you know, then we come back and we're paying for more than gas and all that kind of stuff. And we went into this one event, and we totally overbooked this room in Chattanooga. And one guy had a networking company, and people were also there to network. And there was a tech problem or something, and it wasn't working out. And there was a guy who was standing there, and there's way too many people in the room. And I would only describe him as an old timer. And everyone had, you know, everyone had their name tags, and it would say like Reza Azad, Studio 71. And this guy, his name tag just said PEP, P-E-P. And so I'm trying to kill time. I'm doing like a little bit of crowd work, which you can appreciate as a former comedian, like trying to, and I was like, "PEP, that's a interesting name. Is there a story there?" And he said, "Well, there is. There, would you like to hear it?" And I said, "Sure, I'll hear it." He said, "Well, my granddad, his name was Ira. And my dad, his name was Ira, too. But they didn't want to call him Ira because that was my granddad's name, so they called him Junior. And when I was going to be born, when my folks was fixing to have me, they were going to name me Ira, but they didn't want to call me Ira because that was my granddad's name. They didn't want to call me Junior because that was my dad, so they were stuck. And my mama said I used to kick a lot when I was in her belly like I had a little pep in my step. So ever since I come out, I've been Pep. Now my son, his name's Ira, and we call him Bo. And his son, his name's Ira, and we call him Ira. Now how'd y'all get my email address?" And it was, but it was sort of, we had this mixture. He was interested. He had he had gone to learn about social media, and you know, he did some work with some of the other IRAs that were younger than him and his family that he didn't really understand them. And so it's, I was in this space and was sort of realizing that regardless of what industry people are in, they're having trouble sort of communicating across this digital divide.
Right.
And I knew I wanted to come out to LA and do more content creation, but my wife was finishing her medical education. And so the only way I could get involved and get started was to create digital content.
Right.
And so fast forward a couple of years, I moved out here and I had a web series called Millennial Parents, which sort of fused those two words. And
was Pep involved in the production?
Pep was not. I mean, obviously.
A lot of parental lineage. That
Yeah. He has, I'm sure Netflix is working on a special with him right now. You know, out an hour outside of Chattanooga is just a working title. But, and I came in to Rez's orbit as a content creator, and then quickly was fascinated by all the people from all the different areas and walks of life and sort of interest levels who are in the Studio 71 community. Because one of the things that's most amazing is just the hundreds and hundreds of really prolific creators who aren't just all trying to be discovered as entertainers. There's folks that are doing cool stuff in education, and there's people that are doing interesting things in short form essays and in cooking and in piano lessons and all sorts of things. And so Rez and I sat down and we thought there's a lot of lessons to be learned here from just hearing these people's stories. And let's have some conversations with some of these great creators and sort of see what starts to shake out if we start getting sort of a balance that would necessitate, you know, a bigger, longer form project. And the stories just ended up being so interesting and so useful and so tight and directed that's sort of how the book came together.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And the Pep story specifically. Reza, I think when with both of you, I think it's very different angles of paying attention, right? You paid attention, like the way you recall that story, I can see how you become a content creator, and the way you've paid attention to like how can you evolve a talent, and especially being attentive to how culture is evolving. How does that continue to play a role in how Studio 71 operates, how you operate as a leader? Because it's always changing, but what's, you know, is there a specific point you pay attention to? What is that? Where does your attention focus in all the melee of content creation that goes on?
Okay, that's you can unpack that question.
Yeah. There's a lot.
Look, in the digital space, there's a lot more data that's given to you. So that there's a lot more signals that come from that than you see in traditional. Like if you're a stand-up, finding somebody at the beginning of their career and seeing that all the sort of, I call it, the doors you have to go to get to the top of the mountain, or all the stages you got to go to get to the top of the mountain, that is a much different skill set than sort of identifying somebody who's creating content that has some momentum, because you get to see some of the numbers that are behind the things, even if it's at 50,000 followers, 100,000, you know, early days in somebody's career. And this is, I think, a truism, despite all that, like what the internet has done is it's allowed a lot of talented people who may not have had the opportunity or the moxie, because I think there's a lot of moxie that it takes to say I'm leaving whatever hometown I'm in and coming to LA or New York or wherever 100%. I'm going to get my career going, and dealing with all the financial challenges that creates, and then getting through. The digital sphere has sort of evened a lot of that out. It's allowed a lot of talented people to shine through that may not have had that opportunity. But the world is finite with talent. What Google and Facebook and all these other platforms have not done is inherently made a lot more people talented. And so the question is, what is someone doing that's resonating? And the more you can understand that, the better off we're going to be, because I think, you know, when we're making these choices, particularly when it's not clear, right? You know, what we just started working with the Fine Brothers, right? That's pretty clear. They know how to produce content. They know how to make engaging content. They've been doing it for a long time. That's not a big exercise for us. But when you identify, like we did Matt Santoro very early on, and watch him grow and help him grow, that's a much different sort of exercise in terms of of partnering with, yeah. with people.
And with that,
and the data does give us that, but there's still a lot of touch, like, you know, in terms of like a feel for it.
And that's all gut, right? There's data mixed with exactly. like, I think I feels like this makes me feels
correct.
All the feels.
That's correct.
With that, you know, you mentioned up and coming talent, you mentioned established talent, and you guys have what, 1300 ish channels right now?
So look, we operate very globally.
Sure.
So we have probably 1,000 channels that are talent based and then 300 that are all TV shows, mostly European, because we're owned by a number of European
yep.
broadcasters. So about 1,000 talent in our network in total.
Now, I come from Machinima,
yep.
right? And I've seen the Maker Studios yep. and all the other ones who are pushing tens of thousands of channels.
Yep.
Why dwindle it down to that 1,000?
Well, if your thesis is you're getting into business with talented people because you want to add value, and by the way, you want to participate in that value and all the upside that comes on with that value, you can't do like 10,000. Like you go to Staples Center, they can barely manage the crowd, right? So 10,000 is completely unmanageable. 50, 100,000, it's a very different thing that you're trying to essentially compete with YouTube. That's not our business. Our business is, this is an infinite universe. There's a lot of people talking a lot of stuff on these platforms. Not all of it's super positive, by the way. And we don't want to get caught up in any of that mess, right? We want to have a very clean, well-lit, we know our talent, we know what they're about. It doesn't mean they don't make mistakes, but it just means we understand what everyone's sort of, you know, going for.
Right.
Which means advertisers tend to like to work with culturally relevant things, so hits. They don't like to work in the long tail as much or things that are just much more foreign to them. So it's easier for us to package up and do our part, right, which is help monetize these creators and bring opportunity if we don't have...
No,
you know, a stadium full of them, right?
It's a great differentiator, you know,
right.
when companies are about money and amassing, you know, as much of a platform and reach, which is all fuzzy because, you know, who knows who's doing what real numbers, and you can't manage in the proper sense of the word.
Now where we sit today, though, we have tons of scale. Like, I have a ton of scale.
Right.
You don't need, like, if you focus on hits and you add up enough of them, they actually add up to quite a bit of scale. So it's not that we have no scale. Like in Germany, we're the number one sort of bigger than Vivo, I believe, this month. But it's a combination.
Bigger than David Hasselhoff, though?
Well, who knows if he's in our network. No. But it's a combination of hit TV shows and top tier creators. Here in the U.S., I think we're the 8th largest video publisher on the web. But it's not with everything.
Right.
It's with a very finite, you know, group of people.
That's great. Jake, so I like this book ending.
Yeah.
Because on the talent side, right, you're the collaborator, right? Mm-hmm. And you, when we were talking out in the hallway, it was like that was kind of your entry point or one of them. You're like really getting the joy out of finding different individuals and across multiple spectrums.
Sure.
What is it that you spot in people that you go like, I want to work with that particular individual or that channel?
Yeah. There's a lot of different things. I mean, one of the things that is, I'd say, across all of the folks in this book, sort of the unifying feature that anyone who's worked in sort of creative industries can appreciate is they're all incredibly brave. Like, one of the biggest impediments to getting started with creating videos or getting involved online, whether individual or organizational, is just putting that second and third video out. Like, a lot of people put the first one out and then they start focusing on everything that was wrong with it. And so what I look for when I look for folks to collaborate with or for books that I've done in the past is who's got a real clear voice. Like, who knows exactly who they are and what they're trying to do, and not only that, but who has built a community that likes to exist even when they're not just talking about the video that person or those people have posted. And I think that's been so cool, not only in this project, but in other collaborations that I've had with influencers, is just understanding how those communities have a life of their own. And those people who are commenting on pages and creating their own content that's based on the content of those artists, how it's sort of become sort of a functioning environment itself. And so that's been that's been super cool. And regardless of whether that's with sort of the top of the iceberg creators like Rhett and Link or someone like Matthew Santoro, or if it's with some of the people that we feature in the book, like there's a group called HD Piano out of Chicago, and it's piano lessons.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never would have envisioned that I would have gotten as excited about learning about piano lessons on YouTube. But it's one of those things where they just found a lane, and they do it so well that it makes you, you know, it gets you involved in an activity than you otherwise, you know, would have just assumed you were over, once you'd gotten older. But
so you studied sociology.
Yeah.
Right. You remember that, don't you?
I do, a little bits and pieces.
But a lot of what you're saying is kind of tied into that, like the mm-hmm. social evolution of it all. The sure. creators have fans who then create, and then those, like, it's just a domino, like an endless domino effect.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the softer things either of you
sure.
know, have discovered? And I know the data will tell us like one thing, like where attention is, but the other piece of it is like softer.
Yeah. So I'll tell you a great story that's in the book. There was a kid who lives in England, and he was driving a dump truck at a construction site. And at night, he loved playing Call of Duty, and he wanted to make highlight videos of his Call of Duty montages. And he would put his Call of Duty highlights together, and then he would set them to music, and he would put them on YouTube. But his highlight videos kept getting flagged for third-party copyright infringement. And so he was frustrated, so he started looking for music that didn't have copyright issues, independent music, independent artists, to sort of back his Call of Duty highlight montages. So he puts those on, and it comes from a place of honesty. He's making these videos because he has an honest interest in the content, and people are responding, but they're starting to respond more to the music than his videos. So he starts realizing, oh, well, I'm helping artists get discovered, and I'm learning about more music, and I love music anyways. Flash forward, he gets, you know, more than 100 million views a month now, and he's launching artists in a major, major way. His channel's called No Copyright Sounds. And then what was so funny to me, the irony of the whole thing, is that labels started signing his artists that he was breaking and then slapping copyright infringements on their music, not realizing that they had built fans in this community.
Right.
Of like, hey, let's all enjoy this stuff. Let's all take it, and we'll give your music new life. We'll give you exposure. It was this sort of wonderful cultural trade-based community. And they're like, well, we're going to sign this guy so that we can bring him back into our archaic model.
That's pretty
cool. But he realized, you know, through that sort of what the community was telling him, he essentially created a new way to run a record label and run a record community on that digital platform.
Well, that's phenomenal. And Reza, I would imagine just with like the business changing, because that was a huge problem, obviously, when I was at Machinima or in the early days. It was like, wait, that's our stuff. Don't do anything with it. But it's actually selling your game even more, right? And there's this evolution of just the business models themselves. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you've seen and how you navigate just sort of breaking the rules and like recovering from it?
It's interesting because for a long time we were in this cycle of breaking the rules, right? And that was early days of YouTube. And I think it's getting harder and harder to break the rules and be successful, right? So Google has implemented Content ID, Publisher ID, all these tools for rights holders to come and claim copyrighted materials. The idea of fair use is being litigated more and more and more and more. And this is like the idea that you can take somebody else's photograph or video feed, and because you're wrapping it in a slightly different story, you know, use that in a long period of time. So I think we're actually in, and then you add brand safety to it, which also includes misappropriation of characters mm-hmm. and third-party rights a lot of times. I mean, you add that all up, and I think we're getting into an environment that's going to get more and more and more structured. It's not going to be the same way, structured in the same way it used to be, though,
right?
Because there's, you don't necessarily, I'm not suggesting anyone should take a song, put it on a video, and put it out, because you're automatically subject to some form of litigation. But there are now tools that sort of mitigate a lot of that stuff, but not all of it.
Right.
And so we're it's actually starting to lock down, and that's a function of how big the business has gotten over.
How does that affect the creativity, right? Because I think sometimes there's like, thievery is the best form of flattery. It's a horrible derivative of that quote, but you know what I'm saying.
Look, imitation is the and all great artists steal and all of that stuff. That's absolutely right. But right, so like you take the culture of sampling in hip hop music, everyone gets paid in that culture. So it's because it's worked itself out. The first time somebody did it and it went, they released right. The first rap albums with, you know, people's bass lines and whatnot and drum beats and all that. That took many years to sort out. But today, that's standard issue. Producers cut all kinds of tracks together from third-party music. Everyone clears everything, and it's not now there's an entire process and system around it if you're in the hip-hop business, so that you can actually make a living off of it, because no one wants to put out a ton of work and put your heart and soul in anything and then come out the other end with nothing at the end. Right, that's not, I don't think, a vision any artist has.
Yeah, we had a number of conversations in the book about people sort of taking content and repurposing it and putting it their own and taking it without asking. And it's really a double-edged sword. It used to be, you know, in the earlier days of YouTube, I would say even up to, you know, 2013, maybe even 14, when the goal was to go viral, you know, the idea was,
viral video.
Yeah. The idea was, no matter how it popped, you know, whether it was someone else who took your video and put it on a different, you know, put it on their channel or whatever, like it was always going to come back and benefit you. And there are a number of creators who are in the book who actually popped that way. McJugger Nuggets comes to mind. Yeah. But there are also the other side of that is now, because there are so many more platforms that run independent of each other, you know, there's a lot of instances where you get a little shine off somebody stealing your video, but you don't get the traffic and the exposure on your main platform. So you really have to be, you have to have a presence on a number of platforms to sort of protect against that.
Oh yeah.
But it's something where people are a lot more concerned about it than they used to be when you know, digital video is more of a, you know, an Oklahoma land grab.
That's also, it's such a community. I mean, the same thing happens in podcasting, right? Like the best way to get your podcast out there is to appear on another podcast or put a little piece together or somehow like find a way to collaborate with somebody who has a bigger platform than yours. And there's something to be said about, like, at least in the early days of either of these platforms, whether it's television, you know, YouTube, it's like, hey, we're going to all collaborate and work together and just figure it out. And then, you know, the process starts. You can't have, you know, all the risk and things that you guys mentioned, and also just growth without brands and advertisers. And I think, how do you mitigate that risk for them? Because I know a marketing manager or a CMO might come to the table and like not quite fully understand how to integrate their brand into this ecosystem. So how do you go about educating them on both the ups and the downsides of getting involved with your creators?
This has been an ongoing conversation we've had since the company started. It actually started by being...
I'll get that.
You know, yeah.
Hello?
On two.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
It's funny. I was thinking in my head, you know, that's the first time it's gone off in the hour. What the fuck? No one cares what it's calling me. Like, what's going on around here? I'm actually a little bummed out.
On the 10s and 20s.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, as a former agent,
you're the 33rd
I'm getting
caller.
Like a little edgy that was the only call that's happening.
That's like sometimes I won't have an email for like an hour and I'm like, what is
is
Gmail broken?
Yeah,
I call Google like, hello.
Yeah, no text, no emails, no phone calls. Like, life's, you know, what's happening. The brand thing has been part of the business from day one. So brands want to tell their stories in places where there's high engagement. That goes, I'm being Captain Obvious. So early days, there was a lot of brands that came in. And so managing that process has been like the center part of the business of Studio 71 from day one. the business is really two things. Selling pre-roll ads is very easy, relatively speaking, because creators don't, it's not a lot of conversation. It's something that happens before the video starts. Telling a story with a brand, right? Or having a creator, you know, whether it's a call out or engage with a product or help a brand sort of, you know, reach the audience that the creator has is sometimes a much more complicated thing. Yeah. And it's complicated for two or three reasons. One big reason is the further you go up the food chain in advertising, the less connectivity they have with this kind of content. What I mean is they're watching less and less of it, right? The CMO of a large Fortune 500 company is probably not spending a lot of time trying to understand what's happening in this environment by watching a lot of content. They're trying to understand it from, where are the people? Are these the right customers for me? Am I getting, when I buy, let's say, partner with a Retin Link, is that the customer I want to reach? So they're looking at the top level for the data and the metrics and ROI and all of that. And the reality is, the further you go down the funnel, the more people really understand what's happening here culturally. And sometimes there's a gap, right, where somebody in this decision tree says, well, we got to make it like an ad, or we got to do something that is not really of this culture. And we end up in a somewhat challenged space. But for the most part, if you have a good salesperson and you have a strong sort of partner on the talent side, you can usually navigate that. And the reason I think brands want to engage with this universe is, like, branded content, the biggest challenge with it historically is you go make this perfect piece of content,
right,
and then you got to convince some broadcaster or somebody to watch it. And usually that's really tough. Usually those things don't get fully engaged in the way that people would like. In investing in sort of talent that's putting out content regularly, and you're sort of going into their universe, into their shows, it's much easier. The audience and distribution piece is usually really figured out.
Yeah.
And so there's opportunity to create real reach and real engagement for a brand with a set of consumers. And so that's the opportunity. And I think it's something that a lot of people see.
And I think, also it's like, the willingness to give up a little bit of control. Like you had that anecdote about, like, we've created this beautiful piece of content, here it is, as opposed to, like, they make what kind of videos? And you really?
Right.
I know we did a 15-day Call of Duty live stream, yeah, and Subway came aboard as a sponsor.
Yeah.
And it took a really long time for us to convince them that this was the right move, because, you know, they were worried about the language, yeah, and how people talk to each other. And I think the final line was, all right, well, as long as they don't say fuck while they're eating the sandwich. Like, that's the culture versus, right, the numbers, right? Like, it's, I think that's so well stated. What you wanted to add to?
Well, it's just to that point, it's the mentality is not that we're trying to deliver the perfect message from on high. Like, you're trying to have a leading voice in a conversation. And if that conversation isn't ongoing, then people are going to forget about you. Because there's a lot of interesting conversations to be had. And so the part of the difficulty is that even as late as a few years ago, you were still seeing companies doing, like, derivations of Got Milk, you know? Like, think about how old and tired that was. And here there are people putting out 5 videos a day, and just it was just a language barrier. You know, bringing up games, we had a conversation with a gamer who's in the book named KP. She's a streamer. And one of the things that struck me is she was talking about how she likes to have 4 different monitors going at once. She's, like, playing a couple different games. She's in a couple conversations and she's listening to music on a different one. And the reason she does that is because it's just more efficient.
Right.
And that definition of efficient is so different from the definition of a C-suite executive at a Fortune 500 company who would think, no, efficient is you get one thing done, you do it well, and you move on to the next thing, and you don't waste time or get distracted. And you, the only way that you can jump that gap and become fluent is if you become a part of the conversation. Mm. It's like learning a new language. Like, you can study the books, but like, if you're not out there trying to order at the restaurant or find your way to the library, or that pretty much is the extent of my Spanish. But the, you know, if you're not
bibliotheque.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's a great great dodgeball reference. But
oh, wow, very good.
Yeah, the no, that's really the,
you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
You know, I played dodgeball this weekend with a bunch of 12-year-old girls.
Yeah,
and I got, you should tell the rest of that story,
like,
by the way.
Nobody's business. Did you throw one a little too hard?
Wait, say that again. You did what this weekend?
I have a young daughter, and we went on a daddy daughter sort of fun day with a bunch of her friends, and so we ended up in a dodgeball game. It was like 20-on-20. And schmuck that I am was like, you know, going back to high school with the heat seeker.
Yeah.
And I definitely got admonished for it. So you guys.
Well, that's funny. My daughter just turned 13, yeah, and we went and did laser tag. That was fun. I felt like Jason Bourne that day. Yeah. I was breaking kids' necks and everything.
We did the dodgeball at the trampoline park, where it was a kid's birthday party.
Oh,
when the dads are injured, the trampoline.
Oh, it's because you're just the golden shot is where you graze one foot and it hits into the other foot, but yeah, they're 8 feet. Yeah, it was
falling down.
Yeah, there's a.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. No. This is good. Because watch this transition. Speaking of young ages. Eventually, these audiences grow up, right?
And yeah.
It's in my notes, actually. So you guys did me a favor. But they grow up, right? Over the course of 5-10 years, you go from 13 to 18 to 20. And is that audience still the same, you know? And how do you evolve with them? The reference I was thinking in my head is like Harry Potter, right? The first version of the movie was very like kid friendly. And then by the time you got to, you know, the fifth one, it's like dark and like, whoa, this is Harry Potter, right? He grew up. He's a man now. So if you look at Studio 71 or its content as sort of a life stage brand, or do you, like, how do you navigate sort of the evolution of the audience itself?
You start now.
Sure. I was just going to say, I think a lot of it depends on how people experience your content and your channel. Like, if you're someone who is a family-friendly channel, and part of the reason people watch it is because they, you know, they're kids and they're watching it with their parents, and it's something that you'll always be able to do together, I think it'll be easier for that channel to maintain their same audience without having to do sort of abrupt pivots as it would if you're doing toy unboxings and you're trying to get kids, you know, when they're going off in elementary school. But it's, I think there's audiences because they, and Reza, you can speak to the numbers behind this, but because audiences, when they like a channel, they'll binge it really hard and they'll become devotees. I think the stronger connection they have with the community, the longer they'll stay around. And, you know, if they're just sort of going down the rabbit hole like they would with a Netflix show and the content is one note, then they'll probably move on to the next much quicker.
There's a cycle to fame and a relationship with an audience, and it's not permanent, right? And the cycle is affected by a bunch of different things. So one is publishing volume, right? So if you're taking a break and you come back, sometimes it just doesn't come back. And there's many factors for it, including your content. But essentially, we've seen now several generations of talent, I don't want to say come and go, but definitely evolve.
Right.
And it doesn't always go up and down, by the way. Sometimes it goes up and sideways, or it takes a lot of different directions, and there's a lot of paths. Like, you take the original Wasabi channel, right? You had Alex and Roy, mm-hmm, who were doing it as young kids. I think they were in North Carolina. They were somewhere in the Carolinas, and they were, you know, doing goofy kids videos, doing, I think, music video parodies and sketches. And they moved to LA. They sort of, you know, went their own ways, I think in a positive way. Roy started sort of Guava Juice. So he went and built a completely new audience for young boys, a little bit of gaming and a lot of just being goofy in his apartment and having a great time. And Alex is sort of, you're watching him mature, but he's still reaching that teenage girl, because I think there's the whole lifestyle that he sort of puts out there as a young sort of clean cut YouTuber. So that's a very distinct pivot from where they were when they were 15, 16 doing stuff when they started out to today. You know, Roman Atwood went through that evolution. There's a lot of people that have sort of evolved, but there's no question. If you don't evolve at some point, the jig is up. You're going to have to.
Do they listen to you? You know, I find sometimes talking to creators, especially if they don't live in Hollywood, right? Like, I think you move to LA, you kind of start to learn the ecosystem a little bit. You're in North Carolina. You're like, this is my world. I'm going to do it my way. And, you know, I've been in situations where, we really need you to do this. And I'm sure that happens in traditional artist management as well. But, like, how do you help them grow up in that regard?
It's all a series of suggestions. Because, like, the one thing that I would say is different about this class of creative people versus traditional creative people is these people, at the end of the day, there's the joke of, you know, you'll never work in this town again. That doesn't apply here. Like, essentially, you could burn all your commercial relationships and still get on a video and do whatever you're doing through social media and reach a fairly large audience. So you could, in theory, put your entire thing in jeopardy, but you'll still reach that audience, right? Where that's not the case, right? So, like, you just take sort of traditional entertainer that gets is too hard to deal with, Monique, right? No one's heard from her in years unless she comes out and says, Oprah did this to me and so on and so did that to me. That was because she was a nightmare to deal with.
Right.
Right. So she's been shut out of the business for a large part because no one wants to deal with that kind of crazy. And so that's the big difference here. And so giving counsel is much more about helping people get there versus any hard and fast rules. And that's one of the challenges in working with this talent class. It's what makes it unique. It's definitely a big difference. And so, you know, somebody, the people learn from the reactions of the Monique, these gatekeepers, you know, you piss off Disney and you want to work for Disney. That doesn't happen very long. You know, that doesn't last very long.
I think it's interesting. Another thing that I think of when you bring that up, talking about the sort of suggestions as opposed to the directives from on high, it's much more like, you know, if you look at the way power is generated now, like it used to be that there was a central power station and that central power station fed all the energy out to the grid. And now everybody, you know, some people have solar panels, some people are, you know, creating their own biofuels in their gardens or whatever. Everyone wants to generate their own power. And the grid is still necessary. Without the grid, people can't get their power and there's uneven amounts. But people want to be able to create themselves. And so what you can do is you can give them resources and suggestions to become more powerful. But if you try to tell them that, look, you just need to do exactly what we say because we're the central power station. And at the end of the day, we generate power. They're going to go generate for someone else.
I like that. That's a good analogy. I was going to make a bad power joke, but I won't. Brand safety was like kind of the buzzword of the day or the buzz phrase of the day. And I know you guys just launched a new product that uses AI and human, you know, here eyeballs and ears. So why start that now? Because I felt like brand safety has always been an issue and maybe there was like a huge hockey stick in sort of the awareness of it as an affront, I guess, to some extent. But walk us through like how you guys are approaching brand safety in this new tool context.
Brand safety became an issue. Look, I think there's some things in society that we've all agreed upon that are not cool. Like, let's say racist thought, terrorism, things like that, that we'll call very extreme sort of
points. All the things I love.
Right. That's your I guess. And so when ads are running in those environments, that's not good for anybody. Right. That's not good for the brands. That's not good for Google. That's definitely not good for the creator community because a lot of brands go, wait a second. I mean, I do want to reach a younger audience. YouTube is one of the better places to do that in any sort of media that you're going to buy. But the reality is no one wants to expose their brand to that. Right. It's just no one wants that. And so that there's been a series of these moments that have happened over the course of the last year. In fact, it was April of last year when the first sort of big incident sort of occurred. I think it happened in March, but the effects were in April. And then there was a second one in October. And then there was Logan Paul in January. And then there's the new thing that sort of hit a few days ago. So there's been this sequence of like, what the fuck is going on here stuff. And so around April, we saw a huge hit in sort of revenue coming from the YouTube ecosystem. We'd already built a bunch of tools that were pulling information about our videos so we could search them for brands like, hey, who drinks Coke? Well, if I go ask a bunch of people, I'm going to get a bunch of bad data. But if I see what you have on your Instagram feed and on your YouTube video, I can start to say, all right, this is who drinks Coke and so on and so on. And we were using that to inform who to recommend to brands
right.
to do business. And so that tool suite of tools can be used in a different set of ways. And so one of them is brand safety. So when you pull all the text data, so every video on the internet has a ton of text on it, has a description, has a closed caption, has metadata, all that is funneled out of a video. And we search it for 2,300 keywords, right? And it's some topics that brands, not every brand, wants to be around content that's maybe safe, but talking about depression. Or not every brand wants to be around political content, sure. and so on and so on. And it doesn't mean creators shouldn't express that stuff. It's just that brands, in this case, the customer is always right. The customer may choose not to be in that environment. So we can self-select against that. The next thing is there's a ton of things you can't see, right? So, I mean, or you can't see in just text. You got to actually see it. So we do a bunch of image recognition tools. We use all of the tools. There's a bunch of cloud stuff that's out there, of which the Google sort of cloud API around vision is the best because it's they're already scouring for brands, you know, brand safety themselves. So it's the most efficient way to find out what's happening in the video. Is there a swastika in the video for some reason? Someone firing a gun? Is there is there highly suggestive or sexual or nudity or whatever that may come up? Mostly which doesn't come up in our videos. Like, I don't think we're not signing a bunch of people that have a lot of political speech in what they're doing, especially not really aggressive sort of right or way left of center sure. stuff. And so, but we're now able to look at that. And the last process, and this is where it gets kind of very technical, is a person looks at it. We've got built a tool set that allows us to click, you know, it's about 26 different things we're looking for so that we know what's really going on in these videos. And we essentially, not every video that a person may put out is brand safe, right? And so the way to get to brand safety is not to say this channel is safe or not safe.
Right.
It's to say this video is safe versus anything else. And so that you can avoid all the issues that have happened. And that's how we've sort of set it up. It's exclusive sort of for our content creators. And look, the broader conversation of brand safety, let's assume we exclude the hate speech and terrorists, and I'm sure there's something else, but whatever those, you know,
sure.
extreme religious view kind of stuff, we take that out. Then there's a broader discussion of what is and isn't safe, right? And that's going to be an ongoing dialogue that happens, and it's going to be a dialogue that changes. So what was safe in the 50s is very different than today. And it's going to continue to evolve as sort of we move forward. So that's the thing that everyone's dialing up and down, right? So we have, for the most part, a product that when we say something is safe, we've taken out a lot of the curse words, all the, you know, sexually suggestive stuff. It's kind of G. There's a grade above that and so on. It
right.
looks very much like other rating systems, so the brands can actually make choices and have flexibility around it. And that's it. And on the flip side, brands are auditing what's going on. I mean, as there's all this news stories, there people are looking at everything.
Yeah,
and
they're scared or pulling money out of it. There's like a number of finding alternative means of reaching those audiences. But
I think that's going to prove to be very hard. Like if you really look at it, and this is the other part about it, is I think it's going to be very hard. And I think it's going to be very difficult for a brand to say, I'm just not going to participate. I'm going to take my shit and go home. Because there is a reality that if you just say millennials now in 37, 38. So that's getting up there, right? They own homes now. They buy cars. They're in the stock market. They're making company. They're doing a lot of stuff. and you go younger, I think it's going to be very hard not to be playing in the YouTube, Instagram, to a lesser extent, Facebook mm-hmm. and Snap and Twitter sort of sandbox. I think that's
house party
going to be really, yeah, maybe. Maybe HQ. It's going to be right. hard to not be in that sort of sandbox if you want to sell your products to these customers.
So you guys wrote a book.
Yeah.
As we've established.
Yes.
Why? Like, what do you want people to walk away from, you know, walk away with when they, not walk away from it. What do you want them to walk away with when they encounter the book? They go cover to cover. They should go forth and do what?
First, they should buy it.
They should, and it's easy to find because you can just go to creategreatvideos.com and it's right there. It's amazing how that works. The internet's a wonderful place. I think there's a lot of different things, different buckets that people will get out of this book. As the title suggests, they can read these vignettes, and there's 40 or 50 of them in there, and it'll help them make better videos, whether you're an individual or you're an organization. And you can read this book very quickly, you can sort of pick and choose off the table of contents exactly what you want to learn, and you're going to get some really easy sort of actionable strategies that have been...
Hold on, I'll get it. Hello?
Yeah, that have been learned because these people have been... They're the best because they've been spending every one of their weeks for the last several years making videos. And they may be young and they may not look like executives, but they're the experts. I think culturally, the way that the video generation interacts and the way that they communicate, I think you can learn a lot of things by understanding the way that they consume content. You know, we like to say that we're all a part of pop culture now. And anytime you... try to communicate with someone, whether you're sending them a tweet or whether you're texting them or whether you're DMing them or whether you're emailing them, calling them. Don't call them if they're Gen Z because they don't want to exactly. talk to you on the phone. But
snap.
Yeah. Your competition for their attention are not only their family and friends and their colleagues and their work projects, but also their heroes in life. The athletes they like, the imaginary characters that they follow, the competition for people's attention has never been greater. And so video really is an efficient way to sort of communicate and entertain and get people's attention. And so whether you're doing that personally or professionally, there are stories in this book that can teach you how to be more effective at that. And how to create content that gets people to react. There's a great chapter in the book that focuses on a group called Extra Credits, which is a bunch of gaming executives who now use the knowledge that they picked up on what makes gaming, what makes games interesting, and they've applied it to teaching history. And so they've got a whole series of videos on the Punic Wars from Rome, and all of those videos have millions of hits because when you watch them, it's not a dry lecture. All of a sudden, they're the way the content moves and the way the characters sort of come in and out visually, and they're not even doing a lot sort of in a animated or high production value sure. sense. It's just a pacing thing, and the more you can understand about that sort of rhythm and pace with how the video generation likes communicating, whether you are collaborating, trying to cross intergenerationally collaborate in the office, or whether you're trying to communicate sort of up or down the generational ladder at home. I mean, there are things that you can pull out of the book for those as well.
I love that.
I have a much more simple view than you do.
That's why you got top billing.
That's right. Yeah, top billing because I'm simpler. I mean, look, here, look. Anna Wintour used to sit at the pinnacle of what was driving beauty culture, right? And arguably still does to some level. But she's been completely disintermediated by a group of people living God knows where who just like putting makeup on their face. And they're not necessarily profound experts in it. They don't know, you know, the designers at Chanel or who Virgil Abloh is or the next hot whatever is right. coming down the pike. But they're starting to set the trends. And so when you look at a lot of companies, when they look at their domain expertise and are like, wait a second, I'm getting like my way of communicating historically is being disrupted by, you know, this. And beauty is one where they take it very seriously because I set the trends. Well, no, not always, because somebody else may be setting the trends and you may be missing the trends as a byproduct of that. And so they're very anxiety prone when it comes to, well, how do I play in this space, right? And the second thing is the way they make content and the way historically a lot of people have made content is very different than the way this creator class does, right? It's not as expensive as most people think. If you have a point of view, you will succeed. There's some, and if you right. and if you actually treat it as not just I'm selling you something or I'm let me talk and then don't give me feedback, but if you treat it as like a more of a two-way thing, you can build an audience, and that applies to everybody. And I think that's lost because it seems very complicated, and we got to win fast. And in this space, that's not really the case. And why, you know, the Vogue sort of socials aren't what some random, you know, girl from Poughkeepsie has done. And that the idea that girl is suddenly, you know, and I don't want to compare Kylie Jenner to that girl, but look, Kylie Jenner is selling a ton of makeup. Jeffree Star is selling a ton of makeup.
Yeah.
They're moving product. And so they're starting to creep into the experts space. And I think if you think about all the new companies that are coming out, a lot of the legacy companies, like, look, Tesla is literally video and tweets. That's the entirety of the marketing, right? General Motors will spend $1 billion launching a Chevy insert brand.
Yep.
Or a Ford whatever.
Or these little Tesla pop-ups. Where right.
Meanwhile, this guy has no dealerships to deal with.
Exactly.
And he's literally doing his marketing. And so why? Because he's captured everyone's imagination. He responds. And he's singularly unique. But it doesn't mean your brand couldn't have a similar voice that way. Because it's not like General Motors has no technology. They just never market their brand that way.
Yeah.
If they don't go.
And I think a lot of the misconception is that platform isn't for us. And that's not necessarily the right answer. The right answer is like, how do you integrate your brand in a way that still represents who your brand is, but also represents that culture you're trying to tap into?
Right. I mean, look, again, a couple of videos. I'm like thinking rockets are the coolest fucking shit I've ever seen. They're landing, they're taking off, they're going on this. I'm like, I haven't given a shit about rockets and, you know, for fucking 25 years. And all of a sudden I'm now like all about rockets because this guy's putting video out that people are sharing and is super compelling. And in that case, he's selling a vision, but he's selling it across two large businesses. Yeah. And that's probably not all the marketing they're doing, but that is the public face of the company is a person, and that's really, that to me is the power of this, that a company, an individual can unlock if they get the right sort of stuff.
Well, to build on that, that 15 seconds of rocket video, of seeing that rocket video land, is much more powerful than like listening to a 15-minute TED talk on rocket launching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or but the thing is, the option is, if I'm that user or that viewer that wants to learn more about it, the ecosystem is set up so that instantly I can become not necessarily an expert, but I can educate myself more deeply. Like your newfound infatuation with, you know, yeah. rocket
sure.
launching. Like, oh, sure, you may go to watch the TED talk after sure. that, but it's but that nugget that
I think part of the problem is a lot of companies and organizations and trade associations, they, you know, they're like, well, we just need to make a TED talk and then we'll have a video
or a podcast.
Or we need to do a podcast. And by we need to do a podcast, they're thinking like maybe they'll do 5 episodes. And it's sort of like, you know, how many episodes have you done of this podcast?
I'm in the 200 plus range.
Right.
Yeah.
And how many did it take before it was?
At least 5. Like there was a while. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's this gross oversimplification or overcomplication on either side of that coin, right?
Well, if you think about, if we're staying in rockets, the energy that it takes for a rocket to go up like its first 50 feet, I think is, you can look it up, but it's like equal to what it takes to get into space from that first 50 feet.
I just like looking at rockets.
Right, but if you think about how you're building a content channel, like you're gonna have to, in order, if you want to get off the ground, like you're gonna have to put a lot of energy into it to get it off the ground, and then once it's off the ground, it scales quickly and more efficiently.
This is good. You picked up on that, and like that was off the dome. You should be like in a hip hop site.
You want to know what's funny is that somebody from the hip hop world told me that rocket energy equation.
Oh, who was it?
Yeah, it was Charlie Jabali, who used to run Street Execs in Atlanta. They knew him as CEO Charlie, but now he's Charlie tangent. Rocket.
But no, yeah. As we wind down, I got a couple more questions, but a lot of people look at this as new media, right? And it's been, even though it's been around for a long time, and I think a lot of the ability to reach an audience or the need to reach an audience and cut through the clutter, that is like an age old, like since the beginning of marketing and commerce and buy our product, that's been the problem that needs to be solved. And I think it goes back to kind of what you're talking about, that oversimplification or over complication of it. At the end of the day, it's the same mechanics of businesses of yore. What is there any other sort of primary thing that's tried and true, like the 22 immutable laws of marketing that, you know, never die? Like, what have you guys learned that just will not go away as far as, you know, this content creators in relationship to culture and brands and businesses? Big question, but
I think people are starting, audiences have a couple things. I think audiences have a much more fine-tuned authenticity and bullshit feature filter than they used to. And so they're looking for voices that want to engage in conversation to echo what we've all been talking about. And then I think the in terms of wanting to cut through or shoot through the clutter, the big thing to know is we've got a lot more bullets. And so it's not about, you're not trying to shoot one cannonball through the sail. You keep firing. And that's, that is bordering on sports metaphor simple. But, along the lines of, what was it, Jordan, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take? But, yeah.
He was really good.
As Reza throws up in his mouth, I'll pass him the microphone.
Michael Jordan was so great at math. And you're wearing J's today. Tell me about these shoes.
They're, I think, fours.
No,
that's it.
Yes. Yeah, they're nothing. I think they're a reissue.
You know, 100% of the shoes you don't wear.
That's true. I've got a lot more shoes that I'm not wearing right now. But what about those, the unworn shoes?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't even remember what the question was, but I'm assuming is what are the things that aren't changing the laws? I mean, look, here's what's interesting about the laws. Like, funny is always funny, right? In theory, right? Funny things will always find an audience. But what is funny and how we're engaging with funny, like, especially when you look at Instagram and the memification even of sports and all these things that are really kind of interesting, I think it's evolving what some people will think is funny versus not, and right. What will make you laugh and how quickly you can tell a joke now that used to be, 5 minutes in a stand-up routine could now be, told in a 10-second meme or whatever it may be. So I think the way we get information is going to change radically, and our ability to absorb lots of it quickly is going to be sort of what changes. When you think about Rhett and Link and why are they so relevant and so popular, that's a relationship dynamic, right? I wish I had a friend like Rhett or Link, and I may have that friend, but I just like that dynamic. And are they funny? Of course they're funny. Are they consistent? Yes, they're consistent. Do they present incredibly well in terms of how they, if you look at the volume of work, it's been, pretty unprecedented in terms of the quality that they've sort of delivered. But really what makes them work, it's the two of them together doing their thing, and it's unique to them. And I think those, the individualness of all of the entertainers is what's not going to change, right? Lily Singh's voice, which is an immigrant story, and she's playing her dad who's straight off, fresh off the boat, and the mom who's really traditional, and she's suddenly this hip hop girl kind of living in Toronto and now LA. That's a whole thing. And everyone can relate to that story to some extent, right? And I think that's the you know, what are you got your finger out there? Well, those are the things that are gonna be forever, right?
He was just testing the wind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was gonna say about that is that one of the differences is that sometimes you don't know what your story is until you start talking. And so those, you know, there are some people who start creating content and then their audience tells them what is unique and interesting about them. And there's no reason that brands can't do that, just like individuals do that. We've got a story in here about a guy named Jordan O'Brien who started off doing comedy things, and everyone just kept asking him about his hair. And how does he get his hair to look like that? And where are his shirts from? And he had this sense of style that he didn't realize how interesting it was. It was something that he cared about, but people didn't know that other people cared about the way that he curated his style. So now he does that. His channel's called Gentleman's Cove, and it's a style and culture modern gentleman thing. And so, you know, one of the Lily has refined her voice over the years, and Rhett and Link began as just wanting to talk about, they just tabled conversations that they were going to have on the way into the office when they were carpooling, and they just started having those conversations on video and on their podcast, and so it was authentic. They weren't trying to recreate it, they weren't trying to script it. As Reza said, it was great. An authentic voice.
Yeah, look, out of whether it's Studio 71 or the creators, it's the story of longevity and being able to pivot through, like, and receive feedback like you talked about earlier, and like digest it and turn it into something. As we wind down, I have a pop quiz for both of you. It's really easy.
All right.
It should be easy.
Give I take the New York Times one. I do. I get like 8 out of 10, 8 out of 12. That's usually where I end up with.
Which Studio 71 creator are you? Complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is
being able to see an opportunity when it's nothing.
Spoken like a true manager.
Being able to act on your instinct before you know it's safe.
Tell your story, and your story starts to form. All right. So tell us about the give us one more time where we can find the book, where we can find you all.
Sure. The book is, you can find it. It's on Amazon, but you can also just go to creategreatvideos.com. And I'll be at the Copacabana Club. No, I mean,
Rezazot at everywhere.
There's not that many Rezazot.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I'm easy to find.
Yeah, I'm Big Daddy X at Hotmail.
Verizon.net. I got a Verizon.net email.
Usually at Jake Green or
me, by the way. That's pretty dates, but I'm an Apple guy. I kind of feel like it's not as bad.
Yeah, exactly.
As you know, Hotmail.
My favorite are the people that still have the couple's email address.
Oh, and they're broken up.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that's a whole different.
Which one?
That's like an unmade rom com of the early 2000s. Neither one would. Yeah. Who gets the email address?
Thank you, guys. Cool. You have a good time.
Yeah. Thanks.
Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.